I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, in your packets, you should have the minutes. And I think, from the first two meetings, we're going to start with the minutes from January 10th, 1st. And Representative Omar, will you move the minutes, please?
So moved.
Representative Omar moves the minutes for January 10th, 2017. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, those amendments are adopted. And we also have in your packet the minutes for January 11th. Representative Pugh, you're going to move those minutes?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move the minutes for January 11th.
Representative Pugh moves the minutes for January 11th, 2017. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, those amendments are adopted. Members, today we have in front of us the Department of Military Affairs. Mr. Kerr is here to give us his presentation. And Ms. Roberts, too, has been very helpful in providing some greater details to you. So you should have that both in your packets, too, so feel free to look through those as Mr. Kerr is giving his presentation. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs, and I'm here today to provide you an operational brief and answer some of the questions that were asked in the letter that the Chair sent in late December. And Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to move out with alacrity. If I could have questions held until we get up to the budget portion, I think that will get us to the place where you want to be fastest.
We'll do our best, but we have a tendency to interrupt, so bear with us.
Your committee, however you want to do it, I can roll with it.
All right, Mr. Kerr, take it away.
Very well, Madam Chair, this is my agenda. This was provided, and I do want to point out I did actually provide one new slide, one updated slide, and full-size versions of two slides. Those are in handouts, and I'll mention those when I get to them. But we were able to gain a little bit of additional information that you asked for, and I wanted to get it into the briefing, though it did not come in the read-ahead. So, Madam Chair, the National Guard stands alone from the other reserve components of the Army and Air Force, along with the Marine Corps and the Navy, in that the National Guard under Title 32 United States Code is organized and controlled by the governor of the various states and territories in state service, and only called to active duty under certain circumstances that have been established by the Congress. So most of the time, the National Guard is under the control of the governor, and as such, is not subject to posse comitatus when serving in that capacity, and can be used for law enforcement should the governor decide to do so. Your National Guard currently has about 13,204 soldiers and airmen in it. We are organized with a joint force headquarters here in St. Paul to oversee those activities of those soldiers and airmen, and also to plan and execute the employment should that be necessary in a state active duty situation. The Department of Military Affairs is the state government agency that is responsible to oversee and support the National Guard, and the Adjutant General serves as the commissioner of the agency in addition to being the Adjutant General of the military forces. The Air National Guard structure first, we have two large units, one in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the International Airport, that's the 133rd Airlift Wing. They fly the C-130H3. They have the newest C-130H3s in the Air Force inventory. They do not have the newest C-130s, though, because the active Air Force has completely transitioned now to the C-130J. So we have an advantage and a disadvantage there as they're looking at upgrading C-130Js into the International Guard fleet. Since we have the newest aircraft, that's considered less of a priority for the active Air Force to make that transition. But we had no concerns about the future of this. The only concern that we have with regard to the airframes there is we also have the 934th Air Force Reserve Wing stationed at Minneapolis-St. Paul. They also fly a C-130H3, and we are guarded against the possibility of the Air Force reducing the number of flying wings in a state and looking at those two wings next to each other and saying perhaps one would be adequate. So we're constantly on guard to ensure or to do what we can to prevent the departure of either one of those wings from Minnesota because we feel they both add value to our state. Our other flying wing is the 148th Fighter Wing at Duluth. They fly the newest F-16s in the Air Force's inventory, not just the Air National Guard's, but the Air Force's inventory. And they recently got a mission change to suppression of enemy air defense when they were equipped with those new F-16s. Our hope and desire is that eventually the 148th will transition to the F-35. A recent process was undergone by the Air Force to determine where the first, I believe it was three wings in the Air National Guard for the F-35 stationing would occur. The Duluth was considered but was not selected in this first round. That doesn't concern us at this point, but it does have our interest, and it is something we'll be watching with some focus over the next few years to see where that goes, because we feel that the presence of the 148th Fighter Wing in Duluth is very important to Minnesota generally and to the nation. The Army National Guard, a little bit of a different structure. Though the air is consolidated as two wings, and the airmen that serve in it have to drive to where those wings are, the Army National Guard is distributed through the state of Minnesota. There's a map coming up that shows where those locations are, but much more of a hometown force for most of Minnesota. Our Joint Force Headquarters, as mentioned, is the overseeing headquarters here. We are somewhat unusual in Minnesota is that we have one of eight National Guard Division headquarters located in the state. The 34th Infantry Division is in Rosemont. Their 1st Armored Brigade Combat Team is located here in Minnesota across most of the state. Combat Aviation Brigade that supports the 34th Division is here in the state. We also have a regional support group, the 84th Troop Command, and the 84th Troop Command is an administrative headquarters that is designed to take care of all the units that don't fit into one of those major combat structures, and then the Regional Training Institute. And the four patches that are depicted in the lower left side of the slide, those are the patches of those major units. The Joint Force Headquarters wears the Star of the North patch, 34th Division and its subordinate brigades wear the Red Bull. The Regional Support Group wears the patch with the gold star in the middle, and the 175th Regional Training Institute wears the one with the Minuteman in it. The global war on terror, obviously we've been very busy since 9/11. More than 26,000 airmen and soldiers have been deployed. We have more than 150 deployed today. I will provide you verbally some detail on who they are and where they are. The largest deployment we have right now is the elements of the 2nd Battalion, 135th Infantry, in excess of 200 soldiers, are currently performing the Multinational Force of Observer mission in the Sinai. They are scheduled to return here in a couple of months. We also have some things we call IBUs, itty-bitty units. The 47th Chaplain Detachment, two individuals, they're providing religious support in Eastern Europe. The 1903rd Contracting Team, they provide contract management oversight to deployed units. They are currently mobilizing at Fort Hood. 257th Military Police Company with about 120 folks is getting ready to mobilize, and they will be sent to Guantanamo Bay. We have one of our Chinook units is getting ready to demobilize at Fort Hood, Texas. In a few months, they have been performing combat operations in Afghanistan. Then we have some more small units, elements of the Human Resources Company and the Regional Support Group are being mobilized in an upcoming status. So the game has not changed. The scale is much reduced from what it previously was. But we're looking at this being pretty much the sustained level. We'll have 200 to 500 servicemen mobilized and deployed at any given time for the coming period. Any questions on that?
Go ahead, please.
During the Global War on Terror, we've been conducted operations on every continent, including Antarctica. Our C-130 folks sometimes help out the New York Guard that flies the missions down to support the science mission in Antarctica, so we can actually claim contact on all the continents of the globe. And of some note, our international partnerships, we actually have the longest standing international partnership of its kind with Norway. And our Norwegian exchange will occur this year in February. We also have a long standing relationship with the nation of Croatia. And we feel we're instrumental in their ascension into NATO recently and into their potential accession into the EU. Of course, our state mission. We have not been called as frequently in recent years for natural disasters and emergencies. That's okay with us. We have no problem with that. It's due to a couple things then. We've been lucky from a weather perspective. And two, other entities, public safety, transportation, Department of Transportation, and a lot of county entities have more capability than they used to have. And so there are a lot of incidents that would previously have resulted in calling out the National Guard that are being able to be handled by local authorities. So this does give a recap of the number of days on state active duty in the last 10 years, 27,216. The priorities that were established by the Adjutant General when he went into office 6 years ago, he established six for us. The first is a competent, ready force. Make sure that we're doing what we can to be able to perform the mission that's assigned us, both for the federal and our state mission. The second is to maintain an optimal force structure. This is a little more mundane and more internally focused, but we are responsible to negotiate with the federal government for the type of force structure that exists in Minnesota, and we are constantly analyzing what sorts of new force structure may be emerging that will be of use to us in Minnesota in a dual mission and dual status requirement. For example, one of the things we're looking at here is enhanced cyber capability, because we do see that as an emerging area. The third is sustainable infrastructure. This really has to do with looking at the long term, about how we can maintain the infrastructure we have at an affordable price, and to make sure that we have the right infrastructure and don't keep stuff just because we have it. Our fourth priority is to make sure that we continue to take care of service members and their families. A core element of this is the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program. The fifth element was to enhance the diversity of our force to better match the people of Minnesota, the people that we represent, the people that we serve. When General Nash came in, he took a look around and said, you know, the group of folks that are in the National Guard don't look like the people who now live in Minnesota, and we've made some great strides in diversifying the force over the last 5 years that we're very proud of, because we do think it's important to represent, to look like the people that we serve and be comprised of. And then the last priority is cybersecurity and response. We see that not only as a technological challenge, but also as a physical challenge when bad things happen due to technological failure. I'm going to give you an example real quickly of how we measure, and this is going to be a bit of an eye chart, and I certainly don't expect everyone to look hard, but what I'm trying to do is show you how we have taken those six priorities, broken them into two lines of effort, and then further looked inside each one of those lines of action for measurable, quantifiable criteria that we can use to determine our performances. So I'm just going to give you a quick example of this. The two lines of effort, line of effort one is called providing ready units. That includes competent ready force, optimal force structure, and our cyber response. Within each of those lines of action, we then have identified sub-objectives. And what I want to do is move on to line of effort two, which is, we call it relationship integration. This one has inside of it our diversified the force line of action, and that's one of the areas that you see the most red in down in the bottom. What I want to do is just give you an example of where we go down here. So the next step we're going to go down is into diversify the force. This is the individual flashcard for diversify the force, and we track our performance against measures. You see we have four major sub-performance measures in diversify the force. The little carrot on the bottom of the yellow bar indicates what our performance was the previous quarter. The carrot on the top indicates what our performance is the current quarter, so we can see trend information. And then this is jumping down inside to one of the four subcategories, junior grade diversity. And these are the subcategories within junior grade diversity that all roll up into this other category. So we have a fairly well-developed system to try to determine whether the actions that we're taking are actually having the effect that we want to achieve the outcome that we desire, and we've had some success with that, and this is the process that we use to do this. The command group gets briefed on each one of these lines of action every 6 months in alternating quarters, and they're looked at internally by their champions quarterly. Some of the measures are monthly. This is another measure within that mid-grade diversity, and you can see that our junior grade diversity, we actually slid backward in this particular quarter, but you'll notice that's because we went up in mid-grade diversity. And where do we get our mid-grade people from? Well, the junior grade. So we hurt our junior grade diversity by being able to pull some of them up, and we also pulled some up into the senior grade diversity. So overall, we made progress in this area, and that's the assessment given by the assessment champion. I'm not going to go over that, but I'll leave it in your packet for you. And then the risk that we see moving forward, and we do this for each one of our lines of action, and just wanted to know, to let you know about that. Some other performance metrics in this particular line of action. Our minority membership trend is on the rise. The percentage of members of the National Guard who are of a diverse background has increased from about 8% to over 14%. We're continuing to move that in the right direction. You can see the annual gains. Our female membership trend is increasing at an even higher rate. And we feel also this is very important to what we're doing. And that's all I have to say about the line of action 5 and how we look at those results. Briefly, our economic impact, and we'll talk about more in depth, I think, in bits and pieces here. Our state economic impact, $23 million last year. Federal economic impact, $388 million. Fairly large number of full-time employees, most of those funded directly by the federal government. 13,204 traditional members, 61 facilities and two wings, 50 communities around the state. again, the vast majority of our funding coming from the federal government through either direct federal funding or through our cooperative agreement, which is discussed later in the briefing. Our statewide presence, we have a number of armories around the state. We will be changing this platform, though, and we probably will be looking at reducing our footprint over the coming 30 years, moving from 61 down to about 56 or so. The number is pretty soft yet because there's a lot of variables that have to come together. That will be a combination of divestitures, consolidations, and in some cases new construction in new areas that we haven't been before to come up with that based on the changing demographics in Minnesota and ensuring that we have an opportunity to provide support across the state. I would note that all of our facilities are public buildings and they are available for the public to use under certain circumstances. That's become a lot more challenging in the current force protection status because it's just the first response to potential danger is to lock all the doors and don't let anybody in, which is step one. Put machine guns on the roof is down the road the ways, but we try to stay away from that. But it does make it difficult to try to balance how do we maintain an open facility for the community and still maintain the force protection conditions that are necessary in the current environment.
Madam Chair, I do have a question on this.
We're going to get to a certain spot, and then okay. We're going to take a break. And I've got Pugh first, Representative Pugh.
Okay. Briefly, Camp Ripley, crown jewel of our organization, 53,000-acre regional training facility in central Minnesota, easily accessible from anywhere in the state, major economic impact in Morrison County, a lot of training days, so 358,000 training days last year. Of significance there, 62,000 of those were not DOD. That is, they were law enforcement, county emergency workers, other entities. Minnesota Department of Transportation does all their snowplow driver training there. The State Patrol has their academy there. And we're very happy about that, very proud of that, because we really feel the facility should be used. They exist. They've been paid for. They should be used. And they can enhance the quality of services being provided to the people of Minnesota. The core capabilities that we have to support operations in the state, these are the 10 that are identified. Minnesota is one of few states that actually have all of these 10 core capabilities inside their National Guard force structure. We also have some enhanced capability. The civil support team is actually a full-time active guard and reserve unit, Army and Air, and their purpose is to go to bad places and determine if there are dangers to society, that is, in chemical, nuclear, biological environments. They are to go and detect in the event of a dirty bomb or some other chemical spill or things like that to determine what's there so that appropriate measures can be taken by the local authorities without putting themselves at risk. We also have a traditional force that comprises our emergency response force. They are trained in collapsed structure rescue and also in contaminated structure rescue. We have a counter-drug program that supports local law enforcement in doing drug demand reduction and eradication. We have the last critical infrastructure protection team in the nation. They actually have nationwide support responsibilities now. Very small entity, but it provides counsel to commercial entities and government entities that are not inside the Department of Defense but are critical to national security. We do vulnerability assessments for them, give them a clean eye. We do confidential assessments of their facilities to say, you may want to look at taking some other measures here, or you're well protected, et cetera. And, of course, we do support to our communities. Quick picture of trucks, quick picture of airplanes, quick picture of really boring communications gear. Quick discussion about Yellow Ribbon. There are really two components to our Yellow Ribbon program. This one, the 30, 60, and 90-day events focus on the service members and their families, what we do for them directly as part of their training in correlation to a deployment. But the Yellow Ribbon networks are really external to our organization. This is a coordinated grassroots effort that we have put in place around the state with volunteers to provide services not only to our military but also increasingly to veterans groups, using the resources available in their communities in a manner that they see fit as a true grassroots operation. You'll note 97 Yellow Ribbon networks in 216 cities, 26 counties, 49 Yellow Ribbon companies, and I believe actually I have to update that slide because I think we're up to 51. We feel very strongly that we're supportive of education in the state, higher education particularly. We encourage all of our service members to attend college. We make that available to them through the use of federal programs and state programs. Our state tuition reimbursement program is a huge competitive advantage for us from a recruiting perspective. But beyond our own stuff, we also operate a program called Starbase with direct pass-through funding from DOD. This is a STEM program that does immersion in science, technology, engineering, and math for kids in disadvantaged schools. They come for a week at a time and get immersed in a mission to Mars. And it's a wonderful program to try to stir interest in STEM. It is not a recruiting program. We don't have any tracking data, but we've run more than 50,000 students through this program since 1993. And we know that their educators are very excited. Madam Chair, I do have an org chart. This one does not meet the specification you laid out in your letter. We're still working on that one, and we will have that to you by the 1st of February. But it got a little bit complex trying to figure out how to depict the various subgroups with the federal and state integration that we have. I mentioned about 350 state employees, but many of those work for federal employees and have federal employees working for them, so it's just kind of complicated to depict. But this gives a very rough breakout, and the color coding is as follows. We have the Army National Guard in green, the Air National Guard in blue. Both of those work for General Nash. He also has working for him a joint staff, which has an Army Guard element, an Air Guard element, and a joint element, and a civilian element, which is the box in gray. So that's me over there with my team supporting General Nash and running the agency, and a lot of interconnectedness between each of these various silos or cylinders of excellence.
I'm going to pause you right there.
Sit, please.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Kerr. If I'm on back on page 3, and I'm looking for clarification, please, on the slide entitled Global War on Terror, I see that it says more than 150 are deployed today, but then I heard you speak to 200 in the Sinai, and you referenced other entities. So approximately where are we today with Minnesotans serving elsewhere?
The approximate
elsewhere.
Number is slightly more than 230 today. Thank you, Madam Chair. Slightly more than 230 today.
Okay, and
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so the number of somewhere between 200 and 500 Minnesotans serving elsewhere, is it abroad or just outside of the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, there's a combination of both. We do have soldiers serving on tours in the continental United States and serving overseas as well.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then my second line question is with regard to page 15, the first slide, the domestic operations. And so you were referencing all of the entities that the Department of Military Affairs interfaces with, civil support, and then you mentioned the critical infrastructure protection assessment. Can you just expound upon that a little bit,
Mr. Kerr?
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, so the critical infrastructure protection team is a legacy of a program that was started about 20 years ago inside the Department of Defense to provide subject matter expertise to private entities and public entities that were not within the Department of Defense but had critical infrastructure that was determined to be critical to national security. And these infrastructure protection teams were designed to go out, work cooperatively with the owners of the facilities to conduct vulnerability assessments and make recommendations for security improvements for those facilities.
Are we talking utilities and things of that nature?
In some cases, they're utilities. Yes, Madam Chair, that's a good...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so what I was thinking was that in addition to possibly would the U.S. Bank Stadium fall under that category?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, the actual sites are considered for official use only, and so it would not be appropriate for me to comment on which sites may or may not meet that criteria. But there are a number of sites in Minnesota that do meet that criteria.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kerr, for coming into the committee today. Could you give us a little update on force protection of our armories and recruiting station facilities? I know a summer ago we had the general come in and gave us a little update what he plans on doing. And could you just give this committee a little update on what's been done for protecting our facilities, recruiting stations, and our armories?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, thank you for that question. After the shootings in Chattanooga, which is actually over 2 years ago now, we took some immediate steps to do vulnerability assessments of our own facilities and also increase the force protection condition at each of those facilities. One of the challenges we had is, okay, so what do you do? Well, start by locking the doors, okay? And you put a phone number in the window and say if somebody needs to get in, they need to call the number on the phone. But that means one of our members has to go to the door and let them in. If someone is standing on the other side of the door with an AK-47, it's a bad day for our soldier that goes to let them in. So we looked at what other steps do we need to take. So we added security cameras and intercom systems that allow our folks to make the assessments of who wants to get in our building and is it appropriate to let them in without exposing themselves to danger. We did that in all of our armories. We have just a few that are left. Those that were scheduled for renovation, we decided to take some risk and wait until we actually conducted the renovation and do those installations. But the rest of our armories have been done. Additionally, in our recruiting stations, our storefront recruiting stations that are located away from our facilities, we added ballistic glass shielding so that they cannot be subjected to a drive-by, to an effective drive-by shooting, for example. And those ballistic glass panels are in place in all of our storefront recruiting stations. We also work closely with local law enforcement, not only for our recruiting stations, but for our armors to ensure that we have the appropriate level of liaison so that everyone knows what everybody else's plan is in the event that something bad happens in an armory. In addition to that, we took steps to train and arm our force. We have the capability in every one of our armories to arm using military-grade weapons our full-time force there. We do not do that on a routine basis. We will only do that at the call of the adjutant general if there is a reason to do it based on our own intelligence or based on reports from local law enforcement. But we do have folks that went through extensive training, and the training was really to make sure that we were employing our weapons in a responsible fashion so that our soldiers were capable of doing that in a responsible way. We didn't want a bunch of cowboys out there. But that is at the call of the adjutant general. We also made some changes to our policy with regard to concealed carry. We used to prohibit our service members from storing a privately owned concealed weapon in their vehicle while they were at work. We decided that that was probably not a good idea and was infringing on their civil rights if they chose to carry a weapon. So they now are allowed to store a weapon in their POV so that they can carry to and from work. In addition, we armed the guards at Camp Ripley and at our two Army aviation facilities. They previously were not armed. The act of arming requires a bunch of training, and that training had to be done in excess of the hours that we have them available to guard the gates. They went through the same training protocol that our service members did, which was qualification on their individual weapon as experts, qualification on the military police version of pistol qualification as experts, completion of the Minnesota permit to carry class, and then issuance of the permit to carry to all of our security guards before we went down that road. So those are some of the steps we've taken,
Representative Detmer. And, Chair, just a quick follow-up. With all the improvements you did in the facilities, is there a price tag on this? I know, does this come out of the Department of Defense funds, or how did the agency go about funding that?
Mr. Kirk.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, so there is indeed a price tag of this, and I'm very disappointed that the federal government has been very slow to respond to these requirements. The legislature did step up, and we had a request last year in the supplemental budget that was granted for at least a portion of the amount that we needed. The amount that we needed is actually going to be used to pay for hours to do the training for our armed security guards. But we did some physical improvements, and we used a combination of the maintenance of facilities budget that's provided in the general account, and in some cases we used the maintenance transfer from the enlistment incentives account. So we were able to do that using state money. We are trying to seek federal reimbursement so that we can reinvest that money into the greater purpose for which it was intended, which was maintenance of the facilities. But we felt that we could not wait for the federal government to come through with funding to take the steps necessary.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions at this point? Representative Driscoll.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kerr, earlier this week when you were with us in Veterans Affairs, I didn't recall or this information on slides 34 and 35 weren't in the presentation. That has to do with the Yellow Ribbon Community status. Can you tell me in the 97 Yellow Ribbon Network, is that where you would put the institutions of higher education in that? Or I noticed you have counties and cities and other things that are broken out. I know that we have a number of NSCU campuses and private colleges that are members of that, as I've been involved in helping to organize them to be a part of that network.
Mr. Kirk.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, I believe we count the institutions of higher education as yellow ribbon companies, but I'll confirm that and get back to you. But I believe that they're either in the networks, though. Those are generally communities that are not necessarily tied to a political entity. So I'll confirm that. But I believe they're under yellow ribbon companies.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kirk, just a suggestion. It's your information that you're reporting, but my work with these higher education institutions is they take the yellow ribbon designation very seriously and have done an outstanding job of reaching out to our returning veterans who may have had several deployments where their education has been on track, off track. And I would like to see, possibly, again, it's your information, that they be given a byline of their own so that they can be noted for the work that they're doing to help support our veterans. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here, Mr. Kerr. I just had two questions. The first was, can you speak to why you've seen an increase in the diversity of folks and just sort of some of the strategies that you've used there for recruitment and outreach?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Flanagan, our strategy has been to go to places that we didn't used to recruit and recruit there. I mean, it was really kind of fundamental. One of the challenges that we saw is we were being successful in doing what we were doing. And when you're being successful doing what you're doing, then you tend to continue to do what you're doing. And as we changed the parameters of how we were defining success, it became apparent that we needed to start doing things differently to have the different effect. And so we did a lot of community outreach. We identified targeted populations of concentrations of people of color and went to the places where they were and started recruiting there. Unfortunately, about as hard as it was.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you. Well, that's great news. I just commend you. I think that's important. Just the other piece is Starbase.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that members of this committee or just other legislators just could come observe and visit?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Flanagan, yes, absolutely. They'd love to have that. Madam Chair, I guess I'll look for guidance from you as to how you wanted to handle that from the committee, if that was a committee request or if individual legislators wanted to come look at that. But I'll reach out to the Starbase folks at the 133rd, and they'd be very happy to bring you out there and show you what they do. It's pretty cool.
And Mr. Curry, wasn't it Representative Kahn that has been kind of the champion of that? I'm trying to remember.
Madam Chair, yes, Representative Kahn was actually on the board. In fact, may still be on the board at Starbase. And she was a big champion of that. And we appreciated her support. And it's one of those things that it's 100% federally funded, but there is a state nexus to it. They actually did get some money from the state budget through the Department of Education that they're still struggling to figure out how to spend. And we had some fits and starts here. We got some state money to do maintenance and upkeep to the facility, but we originally got it in bonding, and then we found out we couldn't spend bonding on federal property, so they had to turn in the bonding and get cash. And it was a long story, but the end result is really outstanding. And in fact, Starbase, which is an independent 501c3 that operates the facility, they're trying to expand into Duluth right now, and they think we're going to have the support from the federal side to get the federal funding to do that. But it's a very exciting thing, and it's really useful and a lot of fun to see.
I think we would get an email from Representative Kahn saying, hey, come, and she would have some kind of event for us to attend as legislators. But I'm sure Mr. Kerr will extend that not just to us as State Government Finance Committee, but to all members of the legislature. So if you would be willing to do that. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I'm also on the Board of Directors for Starbase. Representative Kahn.
Well, now we're going to charge you with that time.
She recruited me, and I'm in my second year now on the Board of Directors, and it's been approved that we will be opening up a school up in Duluth. You have to be on a Department of Defense facility. So there's an air base up there that we're going to be starting a program up there, and it's a great program, and it's the Department of Defense money looks like it's coming through, but also it depends on some money from the state too. So,
and before I have you continue with your presentation, I did want you to touch on, since we're talking education here, touch on your tuition assistance program. Can you give me a little update on where you're at on that?
Madam Chair, we actually do, that's queued up at the back end of the brief.
It is? Well, we'll wait for that then.
Okay.
All right. Why don't you go ahead with the staffing levels?
And I would also add, and I'm sure you're going to get probably more detailed information when we actually come in and do the budget briefing, because we are anticipating that we're going to have a shortfall in the next biennium, and we'll show you where that came from, where it's going, and what the assessment of that is. But
okay.
Back to the brief. So, Madam Chair, this is just kind of a rudimentary depiction of how we function. The yellow stick figures represent state employees. The green stick figures represent full-time Army or part-time Army, depending which column they're in, and the blue ones represent same thing, full-time, part-time. Just gives you a rudimentary understanding of what the relationship is to who's doing the work and all that stuff. Norton Security Suite is performing background tasks. That's not a good thing in the middle of a briefing. Another simplistic depiction of our funding, a lot of federal direct spending. In fact, every time we look hard at the federal direct spending, we find out there's more money that we're getting in Minnesota that we weren't counting because it was coming from some other federal coffer. And so it's really quite amazing. But significant economic impact for a relatively small investment on the state side. The depiction of the three major general fund accounts, and I think Ms. Roberts probably has a better, she's got the other accounts listed on the spreadsheet, but these are the three that we kind of consider discretionary that we manage intensively: our maintenance and repair account, our state tuition reimbursement account, and then the general support account. And I think I'm going to wait till we get deeper into the briefing and talk more about that.
And I wonder if it might just be helpful for Ms. Roberts to interject on this piece and kind of give us some direction of where members can be looking to get greater detail on this portion. Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, actually, I think the breakdown that Mr. Kerr has is pretty similar to the level of detail that we track on our spreadsheet, although we do, when you see the spreadsheet that I prepare for the committee, there is additional information that breaks it down between, for example, Camp Ripley, and then Duluth and Twin Cities. And then the other item that I think you may, the other general fund piece is the open general fund appropriation for emergency services, which you talked about when the Guard gets called to state duty for natural disasters and pieces and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we will have a more detailed spreadsheet for the committee soon.
Okay. Mr. Kerr?
Madam Chair, I would mention that we used to brief this slide pretty consistently, and until we got the approval of the legislature to do the reversal, we previously were running a balance in the enlistment incentives account, a fairly substantial one, and we requested that we flip-flop the amounts, and instead of $6.66 million for maintenance and about $10 million in enlistment incentives, we asked to reverse those and move the nearly $10 million to maintenance and training facilities and reduce the amount going into enlistment incentives. At the time, our data indicated that this would allow us to turn the curve and eventually, gradually, slowly reduce the amount of surplus that we had in the enlistment incentives approach so that we would be about $1 million over at the end of the next biennium. Unfortunately, we outperformed our intention and pretty much are running her into the ground this year. So we are going to have to take a look, and we'll explain that in a little more detail toward the end, but that's kind of where we're at. This is a different way of looking at our history. We did actually get back in 12-13 a little bit of a bump in the enlistment incentives appropriation, $3.5 million. We were level the last two biennia, but the distribution inside changed at our request. And we also did get a little plus up in the supplemental of $248,000 last year for the current operating year. General support expenditures, this is a very rudimentary breakout of the two state fiscal years between payroll and non-payroll in the general support account. I believe Ms. Roberts does have a more detailed spreadsheet of our expenditures getting down into more of the sub-detail, and I would be happy to answer questions to the extent that I can regarding what that breakout is. I know that you'll see some lines that appear to repeat themselves, like in-state, out-state travel shows up two or three times. That's because we use those additional lines of accounting to identify sub-entities within. For example, part of this, I have a safety budget for my safety guy to be able to buy safety stuff and travel around the state and do his mission. I gave him his own separate line of accounting so that he knew what he had to work with and could work within those means. Similarly, the Beyond Their Yellow Ribbon team, the reintegration team, has their own kind of separate subset of accounting so that we can budget and provide them the visibility on the front end so they can plan their activities rather than just saying, do we have money this week? Yes, maybe we do. So we laid that out ahead of time, and that's kind of where that comes from. So I'll go through these. The maintenance of military facilities, again, what we thought was significant was to show what we're spending in payroll and what's non-payroll in the total. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about the maintenance because at some point we're going to get down to the FTE count, and you'll notice that we have had a significant growth in FTE. It's 100% federally funded, and I'll explain to you why we did that and what the return on that investment has been. That's upcoming in the briefing. We also did list what we spent so far in the maintenance transfer. I note that that was a $10 million transfer. We've only actually spent about $4.5 million of that. We have $5.5 million that's still out there. That was multi-year money.
Is it encumbered?
Madam Chair, it is not encumbered.
Okay.
Portion of it is, but only a small portion of it is. So we have roughly $500,000 available. I think it's, I'll get back with the exact numbers, $4.5 million or $5.5 million. I can't
remember.
You can
email me the...
Yes,
thank you.
Inside the incentives operating budget, you see relatively small amount of payroll there, a lot of non-payroll. You'll notice we spent a lot of money in 16, more than we anticipated, and so far we're on a pace to spend just under that, which is a good thing. And that has to do with a couple of weird things. I'm getting ahead of myself in the briefing. I'll wait till we get there. But the non-payroll detail, there are four real subcategories of incentives. STR is the State Tuition Reimbursement Program. State Tuition Reimbursement is open to all service members who have completed basic training, and if they go to an institute of higher learning that's accredited and they have to pay for their classes up front and everything they pass, we reimburse them up to 100% of their tuition capped at the U of M rate for undergraduate or graduate if it's graduate school. SRB is the State Reenlistment Bonus. That's a bonus we use to enhance reenlistment only in specific military occupational specialties or Air Force specialty codes that we determine to be short, that we can't afford to take the losses in, so we do incentivize that. The SMB is the State Medical Bonus. That's incentivizing medical, both paramedics and medical professionals, to maintain their credentialing. There's a bonus for completing their credentialing. And then the SRCB is a State Reclassification Bonus. That was authority that was granted, I believe, two sessions ago that allowed us to offer reclassification bonuses for service members, soldiers, and airmen who are interested in going back to retraining from their current military occupational specialty into the one of the specialties that we've identified as particularly critical. And those specialties are almost exclusively cyber-related. One of the challenges that we see moving forward with the cyber emergence is all of those schools to become certified inside the military are extremely long duration. And when a new recruit is talking to their recruiter about joining the National Guard, one of the things that usually comes up is, well, how short can I get away with my training being? Well, you can go be an infantryman in 16 weeks, or you can become a cyber warrior in a year. I think I'll take the 16-week option. It's like, well, you may want to consult with someone first. But anyway, they rarely consult, and so they often go with the shorter school. That means some of these really long-duration schools are difficult to recruit for, and we're trying to encourage folks, particularly in our middle grades, because one of the other challenges we have is not only do we need junior enlisted with those skills, but we need warrant officers, and our pool for selecting warrant officers comes from our middle grade NCOs. So it's really important to try to take people who we think may have the right skill set and incentivize them to go participate in these long-duration schools. So that's an important tool that's been added to our box. We appreciate that, but we are feeling some cost pressure there. There was a question in the letter, Madam Chair, about indirect cost funding. To be clear, the master cooperative agreement with the federal government, the National Guard Bureau, does not allow for indirect cost reimbursement. However, I did want to provide some detail with regard to that. So this is the statutory basis for the master cooperative agreement. Both 32 U.S. Code and Minnesota State Statute are involved in authorizing the Adjutant General to participate in this. There are a number of appendices that are in effect for Minnesota. There is a larger global list of appendices, but basically what they do is they take this master cooperative agreement and then they break into these subsets, and each one of those then has a federal program manager and a state program manager. So, for example, Army National Guard operations and maintenance is different from the Air National Guard facilities and operations maintenance. And that's based in the way the federal budget works. There really is no purple money. It all has to come from either the Army or the Air Force. They can't blend it together. So these independent programs operate in parallel. And it's very interesting to navigate that because, for example, you'll note there are two security guard appendices. We've spent a lot of time working in those. The Air Force security guard appendix prohibits the use of state weapons and ammunition by state security guards, mandates that federal weapons and ammunition must be used. The Army National Guard Security Cooperative Appendix prohibits the use of federal weapons, so the state must purchase the weapons and all the ammunition because we can't use federal weapons, and both of them claim because their lawyers tell them that's the only way it can be. So anyway,
wow.
That's not my problem to resolve at their level, but these are the different appendices that are in effect for Minnesota. And then I did provide some detailed spending, just to give you an idea again of the scope. Detail is the wrong word to use because, frankly, there's not a lot of detail here. This breaks it out by cooperative agreement, but it doesn't really tell you what we're doing there. But most of these are payroll costs. In some cases, we do buy equipment and maintain equipment. For example, our security guards on the Air Force side, they do upgrade their body armor. On the Army side, the state has to do that. So getting into the details of this are very interesting. The way the cooperative agreement works is quite interesting, too, because with the vagaries of federal funding, of course, we're currently under a continuing resolution, which means they can't institute any new programs, and they can only execute old programs at a percentage of what the previous was. Well, if you're looking for a program to have growth in it, you've got to wait till the end of the CR to do that. So we go into the beginning of the year with an agreement with the federal program manager about how much money they're going to spend, and then they modify that as the year goes on. So we really, it's very much a faith-based operation, frankly. We know what our history has been. We get indications from the federal program managers of what their level of resourcing is available, and it's a very slow time to try to do growth in the federal program. Oftentimes what that means is when we have urgent needs, we make up for it on the state side and then try to go renegotiate with the feds to get that reimbursed. And sometimes that means that money becomes unencumbered. This is the air side of cooperative agreement. Again, the appendices, you'll have to refer back a couple slides to see which one of these appendices they are. You'll notice that on the air side, we actually broke it by the two locations, too, because that just made more sense for us. Chargebacks, ma'am, I did enter this slide, and this is one of the supplemental slides that wasn't. There is a chargeback slide in your packet, but this one is updated with more data. Our original slide, we only had 1 year data, but this gives you a little bit of a trend. You'll see the big one there, the $1 million chargeback annually. That is 2 minute, but it's federally funded. So that comes out of our telecom appendix through the cooperative agreement. So that's $1 million that's going to minute annually that is actually coming from the federal government, not from us. But it supports our access and operations. So it's an appropriate chargeback. It doesn't come out of our state budget.
And can you talk to us about the chargeback from the governor's office for 16.5?
Madam Chair, the chargeback from the governor's office, there are two specifics. One of those has to do with the liaison at the national level. I think that's more accurately depicted in Ms. Roberts' spreadsheet. I think that, and I'm not sure if I think the numbers should be the same. Well, I didn't confirm that between the two. That is a chargeback that goes against all state agencies to cover the governor's office costs in liaison with the federal CODA.
Say that again.
I believe that's a chargeback from the governor's office that's levied against all state agencies to cover the costs of maintaining liaison with the federal congressional delegation.
So this is to pay for the Washington?
The Washington office, although they don't have a Washington office anymore, they actually do the work from St. Paul.
Okay. And so how long has this chargeback been in place then?
This fiscal year 13 is what our records show, Madam Chair. It's possible it was before that. We did have a challenge getting in front of FY12 because of the SWIFT transition. We could potentially go in and sift through MAPS data to get data prior to 12, but to my knowledge, it's been going on since 13.
If you could dig into that, that would be helpful. And then just to verify again, you said the minute portion was federal money. And then can you talk to me about, I'm looking at the amended slide that you have on here, and the statewide recruiting piece with MMB chargeback, what is that for?
Madam Chair, that cost is for an individual that MMB has hired. Again, this was charged back, prorated to each state government agency. They should be showing that's to pay for I'm trying to remember the exact title of the individual, but there is an executive diversity recruiter that MMB has employed to try to do a similar thing to what we've done inside our military force by improving the diversity in the governor's cabinet.
Okay. And so I see that escalating in expense. Do you have beyond fiscal year 17?
Madam Chair, I do not, because that's a year-to-year thing. And I'm trying to remember why those numbers are different, and I'll do some research into why that is. It may have changed the formula for proration for us, but I'll confirm that.
Ms. Roberts, do you have some information to add?
Madam Chair, members, I believe I can pull that information out of the budget system. There's a transfer report, so MMB will have put in what they're planning for transfers from other agencies, and I'll get that for you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. And then, Mr. Kerr, I'm also looking at the director of the Office of Enterprise Sustainability for Admin, and you've got fiscal year 17, you've got a chargeback for that as well. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me about that a little bit, too?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is a position, actually a section, that the Department of Administration has added to try to get at sustainability efforts across the state government enterprise. They actually hired a retired Army colonel, Colonel Larry Herkey, who was our construction facilities management officer and did great work in sustainability inside our agency. He was hired by the Department of Administration after he retired from our service, and he is attempting then to carry some of the practices and procedures that we instituted, along with some new ones, across the state government enterprise, again, getting after that sustainability angle to make sure that the things we're doing make sense over the long term from an investment perspective.
Yeah, we met him yesterday, too. And so that didn't come through a legislative appropriation either, correct?
I believe that would be correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Mr. Kerr, what do you have next?
Madam Chair, the carry forward counts.
Hang on, Mr. Kerr. We've got a couple questions. Representative Green.
Sorry, Madam Chair, but just so we don't go by it, because it's skimmed over it, and I just want to be clear with on the chargeback for the governor's office at $16,500, and you said that was for every agency, so every agency is being charged that, or is that the total and divided up between the agencies? And the same question would be for the statewide recruiting.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure what the formula is. I'm not sure if it's prorated by state, by facility, or by state employee. But typically, it's some sort of a formula that's provided on the chargebacks as they go out to the entities, to the agencies, and that's what our number turned out to be.
It's usually by size, I believe. But we'll figure that out. Ms. Roberts will help us with that. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can there be some staff or other information to, I'm not used to how they take their cut of everybody's budget. And so I'd like to understand that, because that's not something I was aware that the governor took a cut from each budget we give out to.
Mr. Representative Kwong, we will be having this conversation, yes. Representative Johnson, I forgot, you are on my list. Did you have a question at one point, or?
Sure, I can ask it at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair. Cybersecurity, I know that your cybersecurity needs and response needs are critical, if not grave. Correct me if I'm wrong. So my question is, where would I see the funding of your cybersecurity needs? Would that be in the minute budget? Is that where we would... The needs that you have be covered?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, no, actually, though we have provided certain services that are basically provision of bandwidth by minute, our computer network is managed by the Department of Defense, and so all of our equipment, all of our parameters, all of our control mechanisms and the restrictions that we have on our systems are directed by the federal government. In fact, we have sometimes great difficulty accessing Minutes network because our systems won't let us talk to their systems because there are some concerns that we have for the state government enterprise through insufficient investment in cybersecurity of their own systems over the previous few years. That we have some concerns about that. We're standing alone on the island, but that it's not very good to be on the island when the rest of the island sank. So we're really trying to take an approach to show how we have concerns based on the things that we're doing aren't being done at the same pace because the funding isn't there. And I will tell you that certainly just because it's a federal program doesn't mean it's good. The feds have had their share of problems too. The very famous data breach into the Department of my OPM, Office of Personnel Management, all my data's gone to China because they basically didn't invest in upgrading their software and hardware so that it was easily hackable, and they stole all my stuff. And I have no illusion of privacy, so call the folks on the Real ID thing. I don't care anymore. Everybody can know everything about me.
Well, Mr. Kerr, I can't imagine that there would ever be a situation where the federal government would want their computers to really communicate with any state computer, no matter what their level of cybersecurity is. I'm guessing that's the case. Would you say that that's the case, or?
Madam Chair, they don't even like their computers to communicate with each other.
Right. See, yeah, that's what I thought. Boy, bugaboo. Representative Johnson, any other questions?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, any other questions at this point? Representative Omar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking at slide 5 and looking at the international partnership and wanted to know how those partnerships are selected and what shape and form do they take.
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, the answer to the question is it depends on when they occurred. The original partnerships were established very much through personal contact. The Norwegian thing was very much, the Adjutant General had some friends from Norway who had friends in Norway, and they said, hey, let's do an exchange some year, and they started doing it, and it stuck. The Croatian partnership was established because former Governor Rudy Perpich was actually working in Croatia after he left office, and called back to General Andriotti and suggested that he should work inside the National Guard Bureau to try to acquire Croatia as a state partner, and that came to fruition. There is actually a formalized process now that the various combatant commands, U.S. EUCOM, U.S. AFRICOM, and U.S. SOUTHCOM, U.S. Pacific Command, all have formalized partnership programs, and when individual nations come up on the net to the combatant commander's office involved, they express their desire to seek a state partner, and then the Department of Defense and the National Guard Bureau work together to try to find suitable matches, what's a suitable match is a very complicated, I could give you an hour and a half briefing on what we use to do that sort of analysis, but perhaps that answered the question.
Representative Omar?
It did. And then the other question I had was, a clarification and inquiry on 15 equipment capabilities are listed, and I was just wondering what happens when these equipments are no longer in use. Where are they stored? How do we dispose of them? Do we donate them? What happens?
Mr. Kerr?
Madam Chair and Representative Omar, almost all of the equipment is the property of the federal government, and depending on what type of equipment it is, there are clear disposition instructions for when a piece of equipment is no longer going to be used. Normally, we turn in large items of equipment back into Army depots, and the depots then dispose of them. Smaller items wind up going to Defense Reutilization Marketing Office in Duluth that are available for sale. There are also some programs that offer certain items of military equipment to law enforcement agencies, city government, county government. And so it kind of depends on what the equipment is and again, where it is. But obviously, we have locations that we store the equipment in when it's not in use, when it's awaiting disposition. But that kind of is a short answer.
Representative Omar.
And then my last question is, earlier you were talking about deployment and how many of Minnesotans are deployed in different places. Are there any that have pending deployment right now that are coming up?
Mr. Kerr?
Madam Chair, Representative Omar, yes. We have a number of small units that are one- and two-person cells that are going off to do some support in various theaters around the country. The largest one we've got upcoming right now, again, that 257th Military Police Company, they're headquartered in Monticello. They're getting ready to mobilize and go to Guantanamo Bay for the year. That's the most significant one. We've got actually an engineer company coming up after that that's going to, I believe, Afghanistan.
Okay. All right. Mr. Kirk, if you want to proceed.
Madam Chair, I'll move from the chart back to the carry forward accounts. First of all, I didn't go into detail on the enlistment incentives appropriation, but typically the authority for that carry forward is in the budget bill. Normally when the budget bill passes, there is language that allows us to carry forward unused amounts into the next year. I think that the details are available in BPAS for what we have carried forward in previous years. And Ms. Roberts, you could correct me if I'm wrong on that. Certainly I can get that information and provide it to the committee if you're interested. And we will be doing some extensive look at that as we get into our budget briefing upcoming. Another carry forward account we have, the Minnesota National Guard Reintegration Program, was established in 2007. It was a one-time $1.5 million appropriation. It was intended to pay for things in the reintegration program that were not authorized for purchase by the feds, so we spend a little bit out of that every year. Some examples of things that we spend that money on, when we had the 1st Brigade Combat Team most recently deployed to Iraq, we had a lot of information that there were a lot of soldiers in that deployment who were coming home without jobs, and so we put together a team of state government and private entity personnel, including Target Corporation, Best Buy, some human resources professionals. We actually flew them to Kuwait to work with the deployed service members to put their resumes in order, give them some coaching on how they should conduct interviews, and we're actually able to resolve what started as about 1,000 soldiers who claimed they were going to be underemployed. We managed down to the eaches and got all but three of them jobs by the time we got back. Either they quit trying and went to school or got down to three. So we consider that to be a very successful program. There was some cost involved. Obviously, buying plane tickets to Kuwait was a big piece of that. The other things we do, we provide refreshments at reintegration events that the federal government won't allow to spend federal funding on. We also will pay for the venues in those cases. We also will pay to ship members of, first of all, employees of state government, not Minnesota, or not our agency, but public safety folks down to remobilization stations. So when folks are coming back from overseas, they can start their in-processing and get some of their reintegration training right there at the mob station. So we pay for some of that. Those are the types of things that we use that money for. And there is about $242,000 remaining in that. That should be enough for a couple of years based on the current utilization rate. And then we'll reevaluate. And then the support our troops account is not appropriated. That's actually proceeds from the license plates, the support our troops license plates. 50% of the proceeds of that wind up coming back to the agency, and we do an annual report on that. I did actually provide last year's annual report as one of the handouts for the meeting today. The next report should be to you within 2 weeks. 1 February is our suspense, and we'll have it done before that. And that gives an annual recap of what we spend those funds for.
We'll probably revisit that when you come back again too.
Certainly. Full-time position status. This is broken up by budget activity, which I believe was requested in the letter. I'll leave this here for a little bit. You'll notice that there are a bunch of things that look very similar. You'll notice the word or the abbreviation MAINT, which of course is maintenance. Almost all of these positions are in our maintenance field, the areas where we've had growth. And you'll notice that some of those move around a little bit. That's over time. We have changed the accounting of some of the positions. For example, I moved our state safety guy, used to be in the maintenance of military facilities, and we moved him out of that and into a different account. So that shows up there. What I would call your attention to, and we'll certainly come back to this slide if you wish, but the next slide, which breaks the positions out differently, and this is by general accounting fund. And basically the short answer here is the Fund 1000 are true state positions. The Fund 3000 are federally reimbursed positions. So as you can see, we maintain pretty much flatline FTEs in the Fund 1000 accounts, and we've grown fairly tremendously inside the Fund 3000, and almost all of that is in our maintenance team.
Can you say that again? So the 1000 is?
Those are true state employees like myself, okay, who are not federally reimbursed.
Okay. Okay, and the $3,000
And the $3,000 are federally reimbursed.
And so then going back to the previous slide, mm-hmm. it looks like there was a change up between the maintenance of military facilities and maintenance salaries fed. So is that a change up from going from federally reimbursed to state reimbursed then, or?
We
Or did I miss that detail?
No, Madam Chair, that's kind of a partial. What it really was is a realignment of how we were doing the accounting to better serve our purposes of trying to track who was in what category. Okay. So we kind of added that maintenance of military facilities account and took all the people out of the maintenance salaries. Well, it's not true. Some of the maintenance salaries fed came out of that and went into.
So you're saying bottom line is that final number in 2016 is a mix of both state and federal still?
Correct, Madam Chair. Okay. That's correct.
All right. Well, yeah
depending on what your which line it's in, that is absolutely correct. And that's why we felt it useful to add this one to give you a better picture of
yes.
what's really happening with the federally reimbursed positions. And then the Fund 2000, those are special appropriation funds or special revenue funds.
Through the state?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
All right, that helps.
There was a request to identify positions pending. We have six currently open. None of these are new positions. These are all filled positions to fill from upward mobility and retirement and termination. And I wanted to talk for a little bit about that growth that we had in those federally supported positions. Most of them in our maintenance appropriation. We identified a number of problems that we were having internally in effectively leveraging federal funding for construction and maintenance. I mentioned the continuing resolution earlier. So almost all of our construction is either 75-25 federal state or 100% federal. Almost all of our renovation is 50-50 federal state. The exceptions are when we have a state-owned building on federal property, the federal government pays 100% of the maintenance on that. Or if we have a state government building on state property that has only a federal nexus, the federal government pays 100% of that. But roughly the rule of thumb is maintenance is 50-50, construction is 75-25. Our challenge was with the federal government's propensity to never have a budget on time and constantly be operating under a continuing resolution. And so we would have visibility that we would have a major construction project that, or even a minor construction project that would be available, supported. But because we didn't actually have a budget and only had a continuing resolution, the law restricted us from doing any new projects. So we would know this is going to be there, but we would not be able to let a contract for the design of the facility because that would be a Nanny Deficiency Act violation because we were encumbering money that we didn't have. And so we were missing a lot of opportunities because as the federal government would delay the implementation of their budget through December and into March, now I've only got 180 days left in the fiscal year to execute a project that I have to leave out for design for 120 days by law, by state law. And we identified that if we could find a way to get some of our projects designed in-house on the shelf using state funds to do that design, we would have an on-the-shelf, shovel-ready project so that when the continuing resolution is resolved and we get a real budget, we already had a design, we could go immediately in a construction contract, which still takes 120 days, but at least would allow us to get started during that year. And, of course, you talk about Minnesota and the timing there. Great, October, we can start digging holes for our foundations. Wonderful. Everybody loves to pour concrete in November. But anyway, it became clear to us, particularly on some of these small projects, having an in-house design capability would be very beneficial. The other thing we're finding is that we had a lot of contracts that were let with poor design that resulted in supplemental agreements that we would have to pay the contractor to do something that was clearly in the design. And I kid you not, this is a real story. We had one renovation to an armory where we had an electrical outlet to go to the garage door opener. And they put up the electrical outlet. And they came back and said, oh, did you want wiring in that conduit? That'll be another $384. We honestly had those things happening, and what we were finding was poor quality control because we didn't have the expertise in-house. Well, what we've done is we've added a design team, mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, a structural engineer. And in addition to doing design on their own, they're also responsible to do quality control on the design we get back from contractors. So when we have big projects that we bid for design, they do the QC, and they ask those questions. How come you aren't showing the right gauge wire in this conduit? You know that's not going to fly. The original designer goes back before we put the construction bid out. We're saving a huge amount of money in supplement agreements and a huge amount of money in time, and that we don't have to go back and renegotiate these things while we're trying to build a building.
But, Mr. Kerr, on that point, we just had Department Administration here yesterday, and their goal, as Commissioner Mossman outlined, was to do exactly these kinds of things. So they provide that expertise and so forth. So is there any federal prohibition from you guys utilizing the Department Administration's staff and expertise for, you know, something to that effect?
Madam Chair, we actually use the state contracting process for all of our construction contracts through the Department of Administration, but they also don't have the expertise to do the quality control because they don't have structural engineers or electrical engineers or mechanical engineers to determine, hey, you didn't look at where the air return is going. It's going to go through that door. You can't have it there. So I think we may be talking about two separate things. The contracting expertise certainly exists in the Department of Administration, but we actually have a contracting section as well that works with delegation of authority from the Department of Administration to get these contracts out there.
What about the Department of Transportation, though? Or there's plenty of other agencies that have the same issues that I'm sure that you're experiencing. Was there any kind of cross communication between the agencies to see if there's something that you guys can share in that? And so it's not a burden that your agency bears alone.
Madam Chair, I can't say that we went directly out and asked for assistance from any other state agency because we saw this as a challenge that we had internally that we could resolve by simply taking available federal funding that was coming to us through the cooperative agreement anyway and increasing the number of employees that we had in these particular skilled areas that allowed us to do that and cut out a bunch of time and a bunch of energy in waiting for the contracting. The other area that we had growth was, again, in the maintenance area. We added building utility mechanics, bums, honest to God, and general repair workers. We used to have general repair workers and general maintenance workers, and back in about 2004 or 5, might have even been before that, we divested of almost all of those folks that did the maintenance in our facilities, moving to contract support. So when something broke in an armory, rather than having the local custodian fix it, they would send a work order into Camp Ripley and they'd let a contract for a local person to come out and fix it. The challenge that we saw was there was not a pride of ownership, and there was also a challenge in that if the contractor was going out to fix the toilet, he fixed the toilet. If he determined that the sink was broken while he was fixing the toilet, he didn't fix the sink because that was a separate work order they'd have to do so that they could, you know. Right. And the problem is we had delays for that. So, okay. I won't go through all these slides, but there actually is some extensive history in how our facilities management operation has grown exponentially since 1982. That's a long time. You would expect that. But there's a number of doublings that occur that really have enhanced the amount of work that we had to do. And the steps that we took in in-house design, I'll call your attention to this slide. We're paying $800,000, and we figure we've saved over $1 million just in those particular 16 projects. And that doesn't account for the agility that we've added, because one of the things that the federal government is also famous for, because of this consternation they have with the continuing resolution and the requirement for money to be encumbered, other states are not as successful in getting the job done and being able to encumber. And so if we have shovel-ready projects, if Alabama can't get their project ready, the money that was set aside for that becomes available, and we can sometimes acquire that funding at the year end. And it's really our facilities management guys are absolutely ecstatic about our ability to go back to National Guard Bureau and say, look, you've got money that needs to be executed before the end of the fiscal year. We can do that. And we've been very successful in enhancing the amount of federal funding we have available then to match the state funding that's available to do the renovation on our buildings and get us out of having broken facilities and into having operational facilities. Facility work orders, we've doubled the number, almost doubled the number of work orders that we're able to do. And I think the comment from the CFMO here, the building utility mechanics and the general repair workers who visit our buildings weekly, contributed to the 25% increase in daily maintenance work. Madam Chair, if there's anything else on that, otherwise I'll shift to executive salary history.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this might be more for the Chair and staff. You brought up the, they had the wrong gauge, and there are, there's code and standard so that you aren't running the wrong gauge, high power, you got fire hazard, et cetera, et cetera. So I would assume that there should be somewhere in the state people that have generic riders for each contract of certain types that contain this craft or that craft that says all work shall be to this code or standard that would save those issues, because I'm surprised we don't already have that. So if there's some place we can find out who in the state does generate that or could generate that and share it and cross-pollinate so that each department doesn't get caught with those issues.
Yeah, I mean, we had this conversation in 2015 with the Department of Administration quite a bit. I don't know, Ms. Roberts, if you we can talk about it some more. It's been an ongoing conversation that we've had on just general contracts and how we're advising agencies across the board in making sure they don't get themselves caught up in a contract that doesn't meet their needs or specifications. So it's an ongoing issue, and so be prepared when we have Department of Admin to come back. That's something that we will want to discuss with them again, too. And now, I think this will be helpful, kind of some of the examples that you've provided to us, too. I'm sure it's not unique to your agency either. So, okay. Representative Gubum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to expound or dig down a little bit on this, you mentioned one thing that perked my interest quite a bit, and that is when you're dealing with outside contractors and things like that, with special use facilities like you have, change orders. And I can imagine that you've seen some pretty extensive costs on change orders when things aren't designed correctly. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Mr. Kirk.
Madam Chair, Representative Uglum, yes, my boss it came from the construction industry before he put his uniform on full time, and he absolutely goes crazy when these supplemental agreements come in and when changes that should have been caught in the design process or shouldn't have needed to be changes at all, like pipes that run into walls that should have gone over the wall instead of through the wall and all the changes that requires. The problem is that we're building complex structures, multi-million dollar facilities that have a lot of moving parts that have to all interact with each other. And so there's a huge potential for conflict between the various systems. And we have been pretty draconian in restricting what we will agree to on a supplemental. So kind of getting back to Representative Kwame's point, not only should there be someone to say, well, that doesn't meet code, but the person that's doing that design, their professional credential, should presumably prevent that occurring in the first place. But everyone does make mistakes, and the codes do change. And the challenge there is we can go back and say, designer, this is your fault. Okay, now we're incurring this huge cost because you failed to properly design it. And our recourse there is, yeah, you're right, we'll have to redesign it at no cost. Well, what about the costs I incurred because the contractor who's actually doing the work has already got this much done and now he's got to change it? Sorry, not my problem. And that's unfortunately the way it works out, is it's not their problem. The poor design, they're liable for their poor design, but they aren't liable for the consequences of their poor design. And so we really saw getting in front of that as an important aspect, because my boss is very attuned that there is a strategy out there among folks that bid on these contracts, bid low, get the bid, and then go in and stick them with the supplementals.
Yeah.
And, we're very conscious of that and very resistant to allowing those conditions to occur.
Representative
One other follow-up then. With your facilities and everything else, by handling it in-house, you mentioned agility. How does having it in-house impact your agility, and also obviously you need readiness for defense and so on and so forth. Are these positive things?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, Representative Uglum. So, first of all, we don't do all the design in-house. We do have an in-house design team. We're very specific about what tasks we give them. The big projects, we know we need to contract out the people that have the capability. But an example would be helipads. At Camp Ripley, we have a number of helipads that were designed to tie down UH-1 Huey helicopters. Then we modernized UH-60 helicopters, and the helipads are too small. Okay, should be no big deal, right? We go out, dig a hole, get some 2x6s, and put some cut. No. The project has to be designed. The concrete slab,
yeah,
by law, has to be designed.
Okay.
So now we have the in-house capability to do that design rather than waiting 120 days to bid the design contract before the designer can start working on that. If he gets his design done in 30 days, now I'm 150 days down the road, before the concrete truck comes out or the guy starts digging a hole. So the agility piece is, if I can do that in-house design, I can have my designers drop everything, get it done in 2 weeks, and we can start putting out the bid to pour the concrete in a much more expedited. That's the agility that I'm talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Kerr, I'm going to have you finish the rest of the slides, and then we'll take questions from there. Okay?
Very good, Madam Chair. The next slide is executive salary history. I am the only employee in the agency that meets the criteria that you asked for. There's my salary history, Madam Chair. The first one is a little bit low because I didn't start this job until into late September. I would argue I'm worth every penny of it. And, Madam Chair, this is where we do anticipate that we're going to have a deficiency in the enlistment incentives appropriation. However, we do not feel that we need a supplemental appropriation. We are prepared to take the necessary measures inside our budget to mitigate that problem. However, we might come back and ask for some language, potentially to move back some of the $10 million we moved into the maintenance appropriation, a one-time transfer. Might ask to move some of that back. My gut feeling right now is we're not going to have to do that. We're watching the numbers very closely and looking at what measures we can take internally in general support, and we feel we're going to be able to take care of that.
And, Mr. Kurt, to that point, though, have you changed your methodology then to measure that, given that, you know, before, just a year ago, you said that that would be something that could work?
We are, Madam Chair, but we're also trying to look at the other variables that have impacted that. So
can you give me some?
I'll get to that one real quick, because this is where we're at, cost pressure analysis. So this is the fundamental problem that we ran into. There's a program called the Federal Tuition Assistance Program. It's obviously a federal program that provides tuition assistance. In fact, we used to direct all of our members to use FTA before they came to us for SDR. And the problem is the Army in particular changed their methodology, limiting the availability of this program to service members who had completed 1 year of service after completing initial entry training. That means 3 years of service. So basically, if we had someone that joined the National Guard and went to college, they wouldn't be eligible for FTA until either late in their junior year or their senior year. So that means that they were falling back on the state tuition reimbursement program. So as you can see, as our FTA use went down, STR went up to accommodate that. In addition to that, so here is...
And when did the feds make that change?
They made that change in FY13.
Okay.
And we saw it manifest itself in 14, 15, and 16. It should be noted that we are working with the congressional delegation and with the Department of the Army to try to educate and inform them about the difficulty this is causing for us, and we hope to have some traction with that. The cards are lining up. It looks like the Army is probably going to go into growth mode. When they go into growth mode, they throw money into incentives, and there's a good chance that we'll be successful in encouraging the feds to reopen that benefit, and that will reduce some of the pressure on STR for us. This is a different way. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
On that program, though, do you have a clawback back if they don't complete their degree at all, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, it has nothing to do with completion of the degree. The FTA program does have a clawback, though, because that actually is upfront money. The STR, we do not have a clawback because it is only after you pass the course, so you meet the criteria before we give you the money.
Got it.
That reduces our requirement to have to go get it back.
Got it.
Another depiction of how the relationship between our incentives funding and STR, FTA is dwindling, but you'll also notice that blue box got a lot bigger than both of them together before. For whatever reason, our service members are bucking the trend and more of them are going to college now than have in the previous years. Despite the fact that enrollment is down at all the public universities throughout the state, our kids are going back to college. So good for them, bad for us. We're looking carefully at the numbers. We do have a request into the governor. He's considering that, and we should see that when this budget comes out. I expect we'll be back talking to you about what we think our needs are. But that's basically where we're at. Our concern, and there's an obvious solution on the table, and that's to reverse the allocation and go back to limiting the maintenance funding. Our concern with that is we were already in the red and getting deeper, and we now believe that right around $10 million a year is the right number to have in the maintenance appropriation to meet the requirement in 16 alpha that says you should have a percentage of your archivist land value or property value in the maintenance group. So let's see where we're at here. I'm trying to get through here quickly. If we don't continue to maintain the facilities we have, they will go away. Part of our strategy to maintain those facilities was to rely on bonding. That became apparent to us in about 2000. We were fairly successful, but what this chart depicts is blue is the assessed requirement line, green is the line supported by the governor, red is the amount passed by the legislature. So clearly as a strategy, at least over the short term, this is not working well for us. This is an extract from a slide of something called RCTMP that I believe I briefed last year, but probably not in any kind of detail. What these crazy charts show is that red and orange are bad. And over time, if we continue on the path that we're on with the number of facilities that we have, the good facilities, which are depicted in green at the top, and the okay facilities in blue, are going to be overwhelmed by the failing facilities and the bad facilities. However, if we divest of some of our facilities and change the structure, and this is really a federal issue, we think we can turn this curve, and that's obviously where we want to go. We need to have more better, fewer bad.
Can you send us a list, too, of the communities that have armories in them? I saw you had a map earlier, but it's hard to read. So.
Okay, list of communities, can do. Madam Chair, toward the end of the brief here, just wanted to show the deferred maintenance that we currently are tracking. About $70 million in the state's obligation. The absolute worst thing you could do, though, would be to give us $70 million because then we wouldn't be able to match it with federal funding. The solution to this is not to solve the whole problem at once, because the other problem that would create is, okay, if we put all new roofs on this year, that means in 20 years I need new roofs for the entire fleet. That's not what we want. So we think, you know, looking at the measured approach to how we maintain our facilities is the right approach. But there's got to be an approach. Okay. Madam Chair, this concludes my briefing. I subject myself to your questions.
Members, any questions at this point? Representative Lynn.
You mentioned bonding. You have a bonding request in now for this fiscal?
Mr. Kerr?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have some projects in the governor's bonding bill that have been proposed.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kerr, do you,
Representative Lum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have you interfaced with the bonding committee here at the legislature?
Mr. Kerr.
Madam Chair, no, we have not. Thank you, Representative Lum.
Might be a good idea.
And Representative, correct me, Mr. Kerr, if this is wrong, but it looks like you have a $2.5 million in asset preservation, $3.5 for the St. Cloud facility, and $4.5 for the West St. Paul facility.
No, ma'am. No? West St. Paul came off and Brainerd went in.
And Brainerd.
And I think the numbers moved a little bit. Madam Chair, we had some challenges with the land issue in West St. Paul, and we're looking at renovation in Brainerd in lieu of the West St. Paul Armory, and that's what was proposed.
Okay.
I think the numbers changed a little bit, too.
All right. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. A couple of us, Representative Detmer and Representative Vogel and Ugalem, are on the Capital Investment Committee last session, and we had the opportunity to go up on the Air Force Base, and I was kind of worried we were going to lose Ugalem up there because he kept hopping on the throttle, I think, on that fighter plane. We were a little worried about him. So I think Detmer had to rein him in, so that was good. But anyways, we got down to also to Camp Ripley, and boy, a lot of neat stuff going on down there, and hats off to you and your you know, everything that's going on with the buildings themselves. You know, we've talked a lot about the buildings today, and hopefully we can get closer to the number that you actually need, and because that graph that you showed us looks pretty bad. And I think we can do better and try to get closer to the governor's number. But just to add to what Representative Ugham was saying, are you planning on to continue? I know you're doing a lot of these other efforts on, you know, with the highway patrol and other people, law enforcement. Are you? We've had a lot of problems the last couple of years with rail safety. Are you going to continue? Is that effort continuing in a bonding request to build that rail safety training center up there on your land?
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, I believe it is. That's actually a public safety project. It is on Camp Ripley, and we will wind up being the managers of the facility. We support the facility, but it is a public safety initiative and not a military affairs initiative.
Thank you.
And I believe it is in the governor's bonding request.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kerr, I know you had some buildings that were all renovated, and then you, I didn't catch it if you mentioned today. How you doing? Didn't you have some storm damage that went through? And just wonder if you could kind of just give us a brief where you're at now. And it was kind of sad timing because I know you were ready almost, I think, for a grand opening or something. And then, but if you could just kind of tell us where you're at.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, we actually had extensive tornado damage at Camp Ripley. And it actually destroyed a number of buildings, four major buildings and I think 23 minor buildings, and did some extensive damage to Minnesota Power's solar installation that was just ready to open. The bad news, good news there is, yeah, the buildings pretty much all had to be torn down. The good news is they're going to be rebuilt at federal expense 100%, and actually will be all about doubled in size because the criteria have changed since that happened. So, yeah, this is not one of the frustrating things about dealing with the federal government. So the strategy for doing that, by the way, is going to be using unused facilities funding from 2013, as long as we can encumber it before the 30th of September. But we have to go through the designer selection process here, and we first have to get authority from the Congress to we have a plan. It's 100% federal, and that's the way we try to want to keep it. We expect that it will, in the end, be a wonderful thing because we'll have replaced a bunch of old buildings with brand-new buildings that are bigger and nicer, all at 100% federal expense. So,
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kara, yeah, that's great to hear. I think it's a good challenge for all of us as members to take a look at what they're doing up there, and other groups in the state could certainly learn from you and what you have going on up there. And I personally, as a legislator, I always like how you join with other, you know, there's a lot of different entities that are involved and you're working with them, and, you know, the collaborations that are going on, the Highway Patrol and the schools, the colleges you're talking about, just really making a much better Minnesota for that. So thank you. But I want to throw out too, I'm on LaSard Sams, and I know that you're making a good effort. You're right there on the river, and you have a great opportunity to be doing work on preserving and protecting kind of the habitat around the base, and hats off for that. And a lot of us here support your efforts there and fixing up the land up there. But is there any chance that we could get a tour, Madam Chair, of the Governor's Lodge, I think, up there? And I didn't see a line item for the aquavit, I think, that's in the freezer up there, but maybe I missed it.
No state funds used for the purchase of alcohol, sir.
At least there. Representative Detmer.
Just one quick one. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kerr, on slide 68, it looks like you're planning on going from 61 facilities to 52. Could you just briefly tell us how you go about deciding that?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, we went through an extensive process to look at a number of factors, which included demographic data and the projections of the state demographer for specific geographic regions. We looked at the existing facilities and the communities they were in. We looked at the opportunities to potentially consolidate between nearby locations. For example, I'll use an example that I like to all the time. Not long ago, a lot of the high schools around Minnesota consolidated. It was very painful. But in the end, I think everyone would agree that it was the right thing to do. And we're looking at a similar strategy in the places where it makes sense. And Madison and Appleton are two locations that are relatively close together. And at this point, it's in our plan to close both the Appleton Armory and the Madison Armory and build a new one in Mapleton, somewhere between them, probably Crest Street and High School. But we think that's a way that we can get a win for everyone. That is, we get our mobile facilities, we maintain a presence in the communities, though we consolidate that presence, so we're maintaining one fewer facility but still providing resources back to that community. There are other places where we will just divest and others where we will just grow because we have the opportunity to do so in a high-growth quarter.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Driscoll. Okay. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Kerr. We welcome you when you have more details for us on the questions that we've asked. Okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, members, we are adjourned.